Well, no easy segue this week from one particular subject to the other. I'm going to begin with the, I suppose, very unsurprising news about Jeremy Corbyn, former leader of the Labour Party, being barred from standing for the Labour Party in Islington North in the forthcoming general election. Why unsurprising? Because actually, Sir Keir has already announced it. What he got last week was his National Executive Committee meeting vote. I couldn't give you a breakdown of who voted which way. Suffice to say that it was a 22 to 12 vote. So the speculation is now whether Corbyn will stand as an independent. I've not heard any speculation about him launching his peace and justice, whatever the hell that is, campaign as a political party, although we shouldn't rule that one out. If he stands as an independent, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know Islington, but I don't know it politically to tell you whether he's on a sure bet or hiding to nothing. All I know is he's represented that particular constituency, I think, for something like 40 years. And at least in terms of people I know who either live or have lived in that constituency, they're full of praise of Corbyn as a constituency MP. He really does work extremely hard at a local level. So I think it's quite conceivable, even in the midst of a general election, that he could get elected. I mean, I'm not going to put money on it, but it wouldn't surprise me. The real question is what significance that would have. And in the middle of a general election, no one's really going to be worrying particularly about Islington North. If the Labour Party lost it, it's not going to be a body blow to Keir Starmer unless he ended up with something like, either a hung parliament or a wafer-thin majority. And that possibility shouldn't be discounted. Certainly, in terms of my political life, the norm for what that word is worth nowadays was always that opposition parties or the opposition party was way ahead in opinion polls. And what happened in the course of general election campaigns is that the government party caught up. Sometimes the opposition party won, sometimes it didn't. But that was the norm. So at the moment, what we're having isn't a year or 2 years or anything like that, but what we've had is consistent polling in Britain indicating a very clear Labour lead now. So 20%, sometimes above 20%. Nonetheless, as I said, if the norm applies, and there's no reason why it should. That's just, how should I put it? That's how things were in the past. Then a Labour government is possible, but also we shouldn't discount the possibility of a Labour government either being forced to do deals. I'll mention the Scottish National Party, but also doing deals with the Socialist Campaign Group. Of MPs, and perhaps also with an independent called Jeremy Corbyn. So we have to ask the question. I think this is the more interesting point. Why the hell has Keir Starmer bothered to purge Jeremy Corbyn? After all, what we've had is a socialist campaign group that's been utterly spineless, utterly useless. And indeed, Corbyn himself has been utterly useless. I mean, he's grown something of a backbone all of a sudden when he was suspended from the parliamentary Labour Party. So, for example, almost uniquely in terms of parliamentarians now, he was prepared, for example, to turn up and speak at the last Stop the War Coalition demonstration on the Ukraine war, for example. He will share a platform still with Andrew Murray, with John Rees or Lindsay German of Stop the War Coalition. Whereas if you take the Socialist Campaign Group, these people are not prepared any longer to directly associate themselves with Stop the War Coalition. And indeed, there was the famous incident at the beginning of the Ukraine war when they did sign a social pacifist statement put out by Stop the War Coalition, only to be threatened by Sir Keir Starmer with withdrawal of the whip, and they all collapsed. And the only ones that didn't had been people that were suspended from the Parliamentary Labour Party. There's two of them. And of course, one of them is Jeremy Corbyn. So I come back to the question of why? Why? And my answer is really precisely to reassure capital that if we look at the Labour Party, it looks like it will win the next general election. And you'll still have, you know, in the Times, in the Financial Times, worries about precisely the influence that the Socialist Campaign Group, the left, could have on a hung parliament or a wafer-thin majority Labour government. And I personally think it's about demonstrating Sir Keir's ruthlessness with the left, and therefore by implication his willingness to stand up to the trade unions and anyone who's threatening the interests of capital. And of course, what we're talking about, particularly with Corbyn, is the relationship between a incoming Labour government and Britain's most important ally, i.e. its master, in the United States. So inevitably, what we have is the reason is because Corbyn didn't sufficiently distance himself from anti-Semitism, and indeed excused anti-Semitism when he said the scale of the problem of anti-Semitism, which I do not recognize as being a genuine problem in the Labour Party. But Corbyn said that the scale of the problem has been vastly over-exaggerated and used by the enemies of the Labour Party. Well, not only by the enemies of the Labour Party, but of course by the Labour right. And of course, what we're dealing with here isn't anti-Semitism. What we're dealing with is anti-Zionism, the colonial project carried out by the Zionists in Israel, which is ongoing, of course, to this day. Okay, having mentioned the SNP, I think it is worthwhile looking at opinion polls in Scotland and just looking at the SNP leadership election. It was a close run thing, but the continuity candidate Hamas Youssef won, 52-48 on the second round. And what's interesting, at least to me, sitting down here in the deep south, is one, okay, he's a continuity candidate, but he seems to be distancing himself from the second referendum campaign that obviously went kaput in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that Scotland doesn't have the right to self-determination. That belongs to the Crown in Parliament and all the rest of it. It's up to the Westminster government whether there's a referendum. And therefore, at least what I'm detecting with him is a shift. And what he's going for in terms of strategy, whether it works or not is an entirely different question, is instead of having, when you have polling in Scotland, are you for independence, are you not for independence, we have a pretty finely balanced thing. I mean, basically, you could say it's 50-50. The last polling, which was last night that I looked at, I think was something like 45-55. It could have been 47-53. This is not including the undecided. But nonetheless, what he's saying, he wants to move towards a position of where there's a steady 60% support for independence. Now, whether that's obtainable, as I said, that's a different question. And I think his strategy, if you can call it that, is precisely looking at the next general election and making the calculation that what we'll have is a narrow result. I mean, you could get a thumping Labour majority and all of that goes out the window. I would not rule out, even though Sir Keir rules it out for good tactical reasons, a Labour-SNP coalition or a Labour-SNP deal. Whatever they say now, when it comes to getting into number 10, when it comes to getting ministerial positions and being in government, they will eat their words, just like Sir Keir said that he will carry on the programme of Jeremy Corbyn. It was a lie. Anyone surely recognised it as a lie when he first said it. We know it's a lie now. So what he says now is about calculation. Not about this is actually what I will do. Anyway, the point I'm really making is, of course, what's happening in Scotland is, although Yousaf himself seems to be enjoying a honeymoon, i.e. his ratings have gone up, which is not surprising as some sort of minister in the SNP government. He's still not as popular as Nicola Sturgeon. But of course, what is going on is the SNP itself, after a bitterly fought campaign, a bitterly fought leadership campaign, its polling has gone down and Labour has gone up. So this is from last night, just looking at the figures. So last night, the figures were 39%, still a very high poll rating, 39% for the SNP, 32% for Labour, and 19% for the Tories. So what we've had is the Tories going up and the Labour Party are going up. And remember, in Westminster, the Labour Party has been reduced to one MP from Scotland. I mean, it used to historically dominate Glasgow and the central belt of Scotland, I would guess, also up in Dundee. There is the sort of myth, of course, of Scotland being Labour, and it has been, at least in terms of my lifetime. But it's also worth recalling that, you know, if I was politically conscious in the early 50s, which I wasn't, then Scotland actually was dominated by the Tories. Either way, what we're seeing is a Labour revival of some sort in Scotland that will matter in terms of the bigger picture, in terms of Britain as a whole. But also, I think the fact that what you've got with Sir Keir Starmer is the fact that it looks like a feasible idea now to say that the Labour Party will win. So in other words, in Scotland, it's no longer simply a choice of choosing the opposition. Do you want the SNP or do you want an opposition Labour Party in Westminster? Who are you going to back? Now, I'm not trying to explain the rise of Scottish nationalism simply on the basis of the domination of the Tories in recent years. The rise of the SNP goes back, way back. And there are many reasons for it, and at least in terms of my memory, the first reason that I recall was oil. The discovery of oil and the exploitation of oil in the North Sea, and the idea that it's our oil. But it's also clearly, when it comes to the SNP winning places like Glasgow, an anti-Tory factor at least at work. Okay. to sort of conclude this section, I thought it was worthwhile quoting this week's Socialist Worker. Again, this is an authoritative quote because it comes from their editorial in this week's paper. And it's basically entitled, I haven't got the exact title, but it's basically entitled, Time to Leave the Labour Party. You know, Jeremy Corbyn has been barred. The Socialist Campaign Group are useless. So get out of the Labour Party and by implication, join the Socialist Workers' Party. But this is their argument. Parliament and elections have never been the most important thing. Strikes, demonstration and riots, such as those happening in Britain, France and Greece and across the world, have always been more important. That's a weird thing for any Marxist to say. Now, it's not a weird thing for a Marxist to say that making revolution, insurrection, for example, is more important than what happens in Parliament. And certainly Marxists don't fetishize what happens in a Parliament. In other words, you know, it's certainly true that debates, you know, in the House of Commons or for that matter in Hollywood are not of the greatest political importance. That is certainly true. Nonetheless, if we think back historically to the origins of Marxism, I do think it's worthwhile emphasizing the point that one of the sources of Marxism and, you know, one of the parties, for example, that the Communist Manifesto and before it, Principles of Communism, the draft written by Frederick Engels, singles out is the Chartist movement in Britain. And what was their aim? Their aim was for universal male suffrage. In Scotland, as I understand it, the Chartist movement was campaigning full stop for universal suffrage. And certainly when Marx was asked, you know, for example, on this, and people said, you know, what about women? He said, well, of course I include women. But that's a secondary point. The point I'm making here is the struggle for the vote. And when you won the vote, the use of the electoral tactic has never been the most important thing in terms of Marxism, but it has been a very important thing. If you take, for example, the program of the Workers' Party in France, famously jointly authored by Marx himself, what that has is a passage in it saying that the working class need to, what's the word? I can't remember the exact phrase, but it basically it needs to organize for political action. And at the time that had a definite meaning. And that was even with a limited franchise, one should use the electoral tactic, not because our delegates would make fantastic speeches, although they can and they would have parliamentary immunity. That is certainly true. Not because of their fantastic speeches in Parliament, but more because you can use the electoral tactics to build the party, test the support of the Workers' Party, test its standing, and actually use this particular tactic to strengthen other aspects of party work. And obviously, the most outstanding example of that in the 19th century into the 20th century, of course, was Germany, where the Social Democratic Party became the biggest party in the Reichstag, but also under even much more extreme limits in terms of the franchise, no women voting, people being forced to work, vote in particular class, courier, departments, the use of the electoral tactic by the Bolsheviks. It's true that the Bolsheviks were famous for, first of all, boycotting the Tsarist Duma, first time correctly, in Lenin's view at least, second time incorrectly, but famously in 1912, the Bolsheviks, I think either won, was it 6 out of 7 of the workers' deputies, or was it 6 out of 6? Either way, this was a huge victory for the Bolsheviks. It's why they thought of themselves in 1917 as the majority party, a majority party, not just because of the 1902-1903 Congress, of where they had a majority of delegates compared with the Mensheviks, the minoritarian faction, but precisely because of their performance in 1912 and elections even before 1912. So if we look at Marxism, what we have certainly with Marx, but also in the Second International, is a commitment to actually use this particular tactic. And what we have, I think, with the present day left is a sort of loss of historic memory on this question. I think the loss of historic memory, you know, we are going to have a online communist forum, I think, in a couple of weeks' time with Mike McNair, who's, I think, at the present time in Chicago at a conference. And one of the sessions he was talking to was Lukács's history and class consciousness. So we're going to have a session on that. I think it's the, yes, it's the 100th anniversary of the publication. And interestingly, that book has had an influence on all manner of different left trends, not least the SWP, who find themselves in a position when they do stand for parliament, that they're shocked when they go canvassing by the attitudes of ordinary working class people. They can't quite get their heads around ordinary folk. But also what you have is a substitution precisely of, what have we got? Strikes, demonstrations, and riots. Where riots historically are a very 18th century and before, not a modern form of at least proletarian struggle. I know that in various countries there are riots, but if you look, for example, I'm not making this as a, you know, a total judgment, but if you look, for example, at Frederick Engels living in Britain, when the Social Democratic Federation led the working class in a riot, I think it was famously up Pall Mall, where the clubs of the aristocracy and the high bourgeoisie had their windows smashed, Engels was not an enthusiast. He thought that this was harking back to a primitive age of the working class. And indeed, the demonstration that the SDF led was a demonstration of the unemployed. The working class, at least in Britain, tends just to go in for strikes and using that industrial muscle rather than the 18th century riot. So anyway, that's an aside. The point I'm really making is to denigrate Parliament, but particularly standing in elections, is profoundly un-Marxist. It sounds leftist, and indeed it is leftist. It is not Marxist, at least in terms of orthodox Marxism. And just to add sort of footnote to all of this, of course, we not only have the Bolsheviks' record of standing in the czarist Duma with all the restrictions that it had, but of course we have the record of the successful record of the Bolsheviks standing in the historic year of 1917 for Soviet elections and going in Soviet elections from being a relatively small minority to their shock, you know, in February, March, to winning a majority in the big cities, you know, Moscow and Petrograd, and then basically doing their deal with the peasant Soviets and the left socialist revolutionaries. The Bolsheviks famously adopt the program, the agrarian program of the Socialist Revolutionary Party, plus one point, and that point was all power to the Soviets. And it was in the name of the Soviets, of course, that the Bolsheviks took power. And that was something that, of course, famously Trotsky had persuaded Lenin of. Lenin was of the view, initially at least, that the Bolsheviks were strong enough just to take power. Trotsky persuaded him that it would be better to wait until the peasant Soviets to go for it then and to take power in the name of the Soviets. Anyway, the point would still be there. These are elections. And although Lenin wasn't waiting himself for the majority, you could say, and I think, you know, I would argue on balance that Trotsky was right, and it was worthwhile waiting till you either directly got a Bolshevik majority in the workers and soldiers Soviets, but also joined that with the peasant Soviets, which was meeting concurrently with the workers and soldiers Soviets. Okay, moving on over the pond. And what we've got, we had an article this week by Dan Lazar speculating about the possible arrest charges being leveled against Donald Trump. Now we have the first reality of it. We still don't know, at least I think we don't know, what exactly the charges are. So we have Trump agreeing, as I understand it, to hand himself in, have his fingerprints taken, his mugshot taken. I think that's Tuesday. And we then have these specific charges. This is what you're being charged with. That's my understanding. Anyway, we're dealing with one Alvin Bragg, and we're also dealing with the New York grand jury. And I'm going to have to rely on Dan Lazar to write a second article or intervene here to explain the workings of the US legal system. Suffice to say, having read Dan Lazar, okay, it's not my only source of information on this one, but I get the general impression that unless they add something pretty additional to, was it Cohen gave Stormy X amount of hush money? No, I didn't sleep with her. I've never had sex with that woman. But this wasn't about sex. This is about campaign contributions. That's my understanding. So it's a breach of campaigning law. But of course, there are other chances to get Trump. Whether they stick is a different question. So Georgia, find me some votes. Was it 11,000 or whatever the hell it was? But there's a whole series of other legal things pending against Trump. And the question that we have to get our heads around is how that's going to play out first and foremost amongst Republican voters. And what I mean by Republican voters is Republicans who will vote in the primaries. That's going to be the first question, not how the country feels, not how, what would you vote in a presidential election, but no, how's it going down with those that will decide who will be the Republican candidate? I think we actually have, I mean, I might be wrong here, two candidates declared, but we also have Ron DeSantis in Florida expected at some point to declare. And again, I haven't, comprehensively read, but what I have read is either a silence on Trump, i.e. at the moment we're not commenting, or a defense of Trump. In other words, if you take DeSantis, he's coming out against the trial of Trump, the arrest of Trump, which to me tells us a lot about his calculation, that he cannot afford under these circumstances to create obvious distance between himself and Trump. And Trump is the leading candidate now, clearly, when it comes to polls, as I understand it, of Republican supporters. That's my understanding of it anyway. Now, of course, it's not true that who wins then in the court will win in 2024. No, but I do think that if Trump does win in the courts or is seen as being persecuted by the Democrat establishment by Republican voters, then there's every chance of him being chosen as the presidential candidate, in spite of the fact that the old, you know, the old official wing, the respectable wing of the Republican Party will be privately fuming at that fact. Now, in terms of what's going on in the United States, I don't know, but I would say that those comrades on the left that sort of poo-poo, you know, Trump and Trumpism and view it as simply, you know, some rerun of Barry Goldwater or whatever it is in the past, I think they miss something. And my own, you know, observation here is going to be January the 6th, because the significance of January the 6th wasn't January the 6th. It was everything that led up to January the 6th. And there you basically had a president doing everything he could do to get the army and the police and the National Guard, the armed wing of the state, involved in politics. And if we look at January the 6th, some people on the left, for example, simply see, well, that was a demonstration that got out of hand. I just think that comrades who have that view can't see the wood for the trees. This wasn't just sort of crazy people, you know, like the MAGA shaman, you know, or the Proud Boys. This particular coup attempt, and it was a coup attempt. So again, comrades on the left, you say it wasn't a coup. It was more like the, you know, the your Munich beer hall putsch. Well, putsch is the word for coup. It was a coup attempt, and the coup attempt basically relied on forcing, persuading, okay, maybe with threats, Mike Pence to go along with discounting various states that had gone Democrat and therefore declaring Trump the victor. That's what it was about. Now, whether the army, whether the CIA would have gone along with that, I don't know. I mean, what I've heard of Miley, for example, is that they wouldn't have. But then the very fact that the army would be directly involved in deciding a presidential election, surely that represents something new, and surely that represents some sort of turning point in American politics. And the fact that we can seriously talk about Trump having been defeated, coming back as the Republican candidate, and the fact that the Democrats are using whatever, how should I put it, legal trick that they can to stop him, surely says something about the state of so-called democracy in the United States. And I'll forget about the popular vote, the state system, the college system, and all of these checks and balances, the Supreme Court, the Senate, and all these checks and balances against democracy. The United States is at best a semi-democracy, but it's becoming more and more semi, isn't it? And that's the point I think that we need to grasp. And therefore, we also need an explanation of why it's becoming more and more semi. And I'm not going to go there in this particular political report, but I do think it's got something to do with the decline of the United States, the decline of the US hegemon. Okay, moving on. No conceivable connection that I can work out, but banning in Britain of, I don't know whether it's called NOS, N-O-S, nitric oxide. This is otherwise known as laughing gas, and I think was administered, you know, by dentists and some doctors back who knows when. But if you go around a British park nowadays, I'm an old git, so I sort of, you know, over the years I've been coming across these little canisters in the park, and I go, sort of, what are they? And I've worked it out. Yeah, what it is little canisters of laughing gas. And this is the chosen drug. Apparently, it's the most popular drug other than alcohol, and I would guess tobacco, but I'm not quite sure. But it's the preferred drug of young people in Britain between 16 and 24. Here are the figures. Since 2010, I don't know if it became popular in 2010, because they banned a load of other highs, by the way. They previously banned, synthetic cannabis and various other things that were legal and you could buy, I think in the back streets. I don't think they were over high street. Either way, they were legal. And then the Tories banned them, obviously with Labour support, outrageous people getting high. But apparently since 2010, there have been 45 deaths from this thing. So I think it can affect brain health. I think apparently it can affect the spine. I'm not a medical person, and haven't read enough to find out why, but 45 people have died. And it reminds me of the brilliantly named advisor that I think the Labour Party, last Labour government had, Professor Nutt. And Professor Nutt was sane. And he would go on the radio and say, well, all this fuss about ecstasy, because people were taking ecstasy and they were being very happy and going to raves, and everyone apparently was kissing each other and, all very fun and all the rest of it. He would just make the point, well, look, yeah, we ought to tell people, what to take, and whether you drink water and make sure, you're taking safe drugs. And wouldn't it be a good idea to actually legalize this stuff so that kids knew what they were taking, just like I do when I go to the pub and drink alcohol. I know the difference between whiskey at 40% and an ordinary pint of beer around 4 or 3. Percent, I know how much to drink. I know when to say I don't think I ought to have another one, etc. But the point is, Professor Nutt pointed out, more people in Britain die of horse riding each year than they did die of ecstasy. That doesn't mean that you would go out and ban horse riding. You might say it's a very good idea to wear a helmet. That's a jolly good idea. Very good idea to go for lessons. Very good idea to know your horse. Very good idea for traffic. People who drive to say this is how you behave if you're passing a horse. All of that stuff in terms of public information would be very sensible. And then any sensible, sane regime would adopt that sort of approach. Instead, what we've got into, again, campaigned and reported on this long, long, long in the Weekly Worker. Instead, what we've got into is this war on drugs. And it might have begun over the Atlantic with Richard Nixon, because certainly I can remember as a young kid, people who were addicted to heroin being legally prescribed by doctors methadone. At least that was my memory. And certainly cannabis was legal, certainly when I was a kid, not that I took it, I'm talking about very young, what do they call them, blue hearts, that was the big, I think that's amphetamines. But I mean, we've all read our literature. I'm, a little bit of a fan of Sherlock Holmes, who famously injected himself with one substance or another, and certainly went to Limehouse to indulge himself with opium and have dreams and all the rest of it. Anyway, the point I'm making is that this war on drugs is, historically speaking, a pretty recent phenomenon. And, I think maybe in Britain, in terms of this, we've got to crack down on the lower orders. And I could be completely wrong on this, but the one that sticks in my mind is Lloyd George. And that is watering the workers' beer in World War One. And specifically what he was talking about was munitions workers. And this is when beer was basically watered down So it was weak as piss. And they also introduced licensing hours. So in Britain, I think it was worse in Scotland. No pubs were open in Scotland, I think, on Sunday. Either way, I can remember pubs closing late morning, only opening in the evening, and then closing at 10:30. And I certainly know in Scotland what used to happen. It was the same in Australia, is that workers would come out of the shipyard, for example, have their pints of heavy, and then go on to the whiskey and get themselves pissed out of their heads, basically because their jobs, drove them in that direction. And it was the Labour Party, from my memory, that sort of civilised our licensing hours in Britain and made us much more European. And it's still true that when it comes to booze, this puts the 45 deaths from nitrous oxide into context. What we have is an annual death in Britain of 10,000 attributed to alcohol. So that's alcohol, liver and all the rest of it, because it was a car accidents, violence, blah, blah, blah. Again, just to finish on that, the government's own advisory body, the Advisory Council on the Misuse, not use, misuse of drugs, urged them not to go in for this ban. So what we now have, I've just been reading, is police raids on news agents and other outlets for these canisters, driving them underground. And so what do the kids do now? Well, they'll turn to something else. Of course they will. Because part of human culture, ever since the dawn, I wouldn't say of history, prehistory, ever since we became human, has involved taking various substances, partially because of religion and some sort of spiritual communion, but also because human beings like a party and they take alcohol, they take mushrooms, they take drugs of all sorts of different varieties. But the point would be, that for the vast majority of human history, we've known what we are consuming. And the older generation will advise the young of how to do it, what to do and what not to do. Nowadays, young people are left to their own devices, and that's not a good idea. So down on the war of drugs. And just to add, of course, that the Labour Party's backed, under Keir Starmer's backed this ban. Utterly irrational. Okay, here's something else I'm not very knowledgeable of. Okay, you should keep your mouth shut if you're not knowledgeable. Hopefully we'll have a knowledgeable article in this week's Weekly Worker, maybe next week's Weekly Worker. And this is the letter, I think it was sponsored by Elon Musk, but it's also involved Apple's Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, and I read 1,800 other signatures, including Xi Jinping. This reminds me of the Great Charter in Britain with, I think there were a whole number of different signatures who signed themselves, Queen Victoria and the Duke of Wellington. Either way, what we have is a lot of prominent people in California and elsewhere in the United States signing up to Musk's call for a 6-month moratorium on the development of artificial intelligence. Now, it's true that there are loads of people objecting. Okay, so what's his argument? And I haven't read the statement. I've only read reports about the statement. So it's a weakness in terms of my argument. But what he's got is real signatures from engineers at Amazon, DeepMind, Google, Meta, and Microsoft. And I think in terms of his actual statement, he actually says that we don't want AI going beyond GPT-4. Now, I'd never heard of GPT-4. I've heard of DeepMind. I've heard of these supercomputers that can beat human beings, not only at chess, that's passé, but at Go. We've all heard of the latest computing stuff in terms of you know, writing poetry, writing songs, doing huge calculations in an extraordinarily short period of time, but basically artificial intelligence being creative. This is the idea. Now, it's true. So I'm told. I've just looked up. I was completely separate. I looked up essays, artificial intelligence essay writing, because apparently in some education systems now, the kids are being allowed to use artificial intelligence, and in others, we have plague, you know, people looking for plagiarization. So I'm not up to speed on this one, but basically we're starting to get there, of where artificial intelligence can write you something that could pass as human, and therefore we're getting into the realm of the famous Turing test. And my memory of the Turing test, this is Alan Turing, of course, was, well, if you're in a separate room and there's a computer in another room and you're talking to this computer, but you can't recognize it's a computer, then it's got consciousness. That was his test of consciousness. If you or me are saying, well, whoever's in the next room, oh, it's really sunny out there and I'm really feeling nice and warm, and that computer could have a discussion and say, yeah, I'm feeling really great. It's been great going out into the park today. And yeah, I saw those little canisters there, what the kids get up to next, and, you know, that sort of a conversation. Then you're dealing with consciousness. Now, I'm not convinced on that one myself. My own test would actually be, for what it's worth, is the computer turns around to you and you say, well, how's it going? And you can call it whatever you want. You call it Alan, couldn't you? How's it going, Alan? And Alan computer turns around to you. You don't know it's a computer. You don't know it's an say, I'm really bored. I am bored out of my mind. Or sod it, I'm going on strike. Then I might be dealing, to me at least, with consciousness, because what I think we know when it comes to artificial intelligence, one of the complaints is that it's the programmers still that program these things. And what we have is a cultural bias, for example, against Black people, against working class people. We have a cultural bias towards Brits and Americans and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So you put garbage in and you get garbage out, and I giggle. The idea that these machines, you know, at the moment at least, are self-conscious in the sense that you could persuade them through an argument or out of their own self-interest, for example, as you could with a human being, I don't know. Either way, I also, again, I could be talking absolute rubbish. I also have a slight suspicion that Elon Musk is a brilliant self-publicist. And so I was also reading that along with Microsoft, his OpenAI, his company, has been developing this, well, let me get it right, GPT-4. In other words, is he actually making the claim that GPT-4 is the most advanced artificial intelligence? I invest in this company, boost its share prices in the similar manner that he did with Tesla. And we've seen in terms of similar operations like with Uber and, well, that's the one that comes to my mind, you know, companies that don't make a profit but can make the owners billionaires because people buy in to the shares of these companies. I don't know. So what we have, at least in Britain, and I'm sure it's the same in the United States, is a sort of a moral panic about artificial intelligence. For what it's worth, and it ain't worth anything, I think that what matters when it comes to the inventions of human beings is they can be used for the benefit of humanity, but capitalism will use what can be a benefit for humanity in the interests of MC, M prime, M plus, money plus. And that can also involve going to war. And yes, you could get a situation of where instead of having General Milley deciding US strategy, what you go over to is artificial intelligence, because it can react in a nanosecond as opposed to going into a panic and having a conference and consulting people. So my own take on it certainly isn't that of the so-called Luddites. I don't think the Luddites really were Luddites. I think that the Luddites, you know, broke up machines as part of a riot culture. They weren't in principle against machines. They were defending their position as skilled workers. So capital, I think, is at the stage now. I think what that where we're going is not only our machines have historically replaced manual labor on a huge scale, but I think that we're moving towards a situation of where machines will replace mental labor on a huge scale. And my understanding is that will include programmers who are still pretty rare and in relative terms have skills that are much sought after and are highly paid. Okay, moving on. What time are we? 51, so I'll start to round up. Just thought it was worthwhile commenting on strikes in Britain. They are still taking place. We're due to see junior doctors. I think that's about 40% of doctors in the NHS. Go on strike. This, I think it's going to be for 3 days, might be 4 days. Either way, what we also have is an ongoing dispute with the National Education Union. And the Tories, I think, are offering something like 5% plus a one-off payment of £1,000. And my understanding is that the leadership of the NEU, I think, are recommending rejection. Quite right. We also have figures showing that instead of inflation going down, the latest figures we have is inflation actually going up. So inflation at the moment in Britain is 10% plus. So, you know, you have a pay offer to workers of 4 or 5%. And really what we're dealing with, of course, even with £1,000 one-off payment, is a pay cut. But that also, interestingly, went hand in hand with a survey of teachers, which revealed that on average, teachers are doing a 12-hour day. What we're talking about here, of course, is 12 hours for 5 days, 5 days a week. My response to that is no wonder so many teachers report burnout. No wonder so many of them leave the profession, because what we're dealing with here is a combination of what is expected by the employers, which is no longer as it was the local authorities, but is now what we have is basically privatization of education with academies. But what we also have is careerism, that if you want to get a sort of reasonable pay as a teacher, you have to get on the career ladder. And what they expect in order for you to progress on the career ladder, is 12 hours a day. You also need to factor in, just like you would with the medical side of things, you know, like not just doctors, but nurses, porters, you know, NHS staff in general. It's just the fact that they're treating human beings, and teachers, most teachers, do not hate children. Some do. Maybe at my school, there was a bigger proportion that hated children. Either way, I mean, I certainly came across really good teachers, really humane teachers, who would always go the extra mile and would try to teach me how to read and write, and would engage with me, you know, in terms of discussion and debate. And that really did affect my life. And I'm grateful to those teachers. So we have a combination of factors of why teachers are working such long hours, but it does lead to burnout, and it does lead to teachers, you know, having mental breakdowns, physical breakdowns, and I cannot take it. And we get low pay. Okay, there is a compensation, long holidays, but increasingly what you get, the higher up the ladder you get, the more you're expected to put in those long days. When it comes to Easter holidays, summer holidays, winter holidays. And I just wanted to make the point, really, that Marx made in Capital, looking at the struggle in Britain in particular, for the 10-hour day. And the need for the left to understand the importance of forcibly, through laws, limiting the hours that workers put in. We do not stand by the slogan, the right to work, if that means you have the right to work endless hours and to compete one worker against another worker. We want a situation precisely of where laws are limited, and therefore the employers have to hire more workers as opposed to work workers longer on overtime and have them competing one against the other. So the political economy of the working class arises within capitalism, and it pushes against the logic of capitalism. But it begins not only with wages, but time. If you haven't got time, how on earth can the workers hope to become a ruling class? How are they going to find time to study? How are they going to find the time to form themselves into a political party? If, for example, as they were doing in classical capitalism in Britain, they were working not 12 hours a day, but 13, 14 hours a day. And that included kids, to the point where capitalism was actually acting in a cannibalistic way, and the working class was not reproducing itself, and you had to import workers from outside, for example, obviously the countryside, but also Ireland, and in more recent times, of course, from the colonies. Okay, lastly, so I don't want to overrun too much after the hour, but I think this is an interesting subject, and this is the Scott Trust. This is the trust that owns the Guardian newspaper. I think they own a load of other titles, but I think they've sold a lot of these more local and specialist titles off. The flagship is the Guardian. And after 2 years of research, they've apparently come up with this startling discovery that John Edward Taylor, the founder of what was then the Manchester Guardian, and I think that was in the 1830s, had links with the slave trade. The Guardian, Manchester Guardian, was a radical paper. It was for the extension of the franchise. It was anti-Tory paper. Anyway, the point would be that what a discovery. Well, to me, it's just bleeding obvious that anyone in the bourgeoisie, anyone in the aristocracy, surely in Britain, had links with the slave trade. It's impossible, impossible that they didn't. I mean, if you look at Shakespeare, he had links with the slave trade. Of course he did. Anyone who had a bit of spare money would invest it in some ship that was going out to Africa that would seize slaves or trade slaves with Arabs and then take them over to the colonies or to the Caribbean and sell them at a huge, huge profit. So, of course, they had links. That isn't a discovery. You name me one institution that, you know, goes back several hundred years. And I think, you know, the Church of England, of course, but also other churches would have had links. The royal family, obviously, but the Duke of this and the whatever of the other, of course, they all had links with the slave trade. Okay. Worthwhile saying, of course, that slavery goes back way, 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 way back to the origins of class society. And you could view slavery as a civilizing move. I think it's a dubious argument, but the argument would be that instead of butchering your captives, you enslave them. Now, it also has to be said that apart from slavery being joined to commodity production, pre-capitalist slavery would have been relatively benign compared with when you join it with commodity production. So famously, in the ancient world, the silver mines of Athens, that's commodity production. You're producing silver as a commodity, and you compare the lot of those slaves with domestic slaves, They lived in different worlds. It also should be said that the first generation of slaves in the West Indies and the Americas, in terms of British colonies, were the scum of London and other such cities that either were sent there as indentured labor, but to all intents and purposes were slaves, and who died out extremely quickly. They didn't last, you know, more than a year, 2 years, 3 years. That would be the norm. And then, of course, they turn, having, how should I put it, wiped out, I would have thought, accidentally, most of the native population, you know, with diseases like smallpox, or the natives simply saw this barbarism and went to the hills or got themselves out of it, they turned to black slavery. And so, you know, the figures are very hard to come by, but in terms of how people died when they got to the West Indies or got to the colonies in America, we do have very good records. Good percentage would die within the first year. A good percentage died in passage. I think it's something like 10% died in passage. 4 or 5% died in harbor. To survive three or more years, that was something. So you had to keep importing labor from Africa. Eventually, when the slave trade was banned and the British Empire got involved in stopping the slave trade, then you breed them internally, and that's much more expensive, but that was what was happening. You have to, you know, have family units. You have to, you know, have to have time off to look after the kids. You don't simply just pay out for a slave. It's more expensive. Either way, the point I'm really making here is that the Guardian's response is to put aside 10 million quid over 10 years to pay reparations. And who are they paying reparations to? Not to the ancestors of the lumpen proletariat in London, not to the vast majority of the descendants of the slave trade in the Caribbean, i.e. the majority of the population, or the United States. What they're doing, this is just, you couldn't make it up. Mid-career black journalists. I mean, this just strikes me as, you know, a subsidy for the middle class blacks that were created basically after the civil rights movement. The decision in the United States to recruit a middle class, to make a middle class amongst blacks. And in my view, the whole approach of reparations is morally wrong, but also politically, it's completely diversionary. Because what we want is not the capitalists paying guilt money. What we want is the proletariat, whatever their color, whatever their nationality, taking hold of capital. Because we need to understand that capital was not only accumulated. I mean, this is the last section of Das Kapital, volume one. Original capital accumulation not only happened on the basis of the transatlantic slave trade and the production of sugar, tobacco, and all the rest of it, and the importing of that through ports such as Liverpool, Bristol, Glasgow. But it also happened on the basis of the separation of British peasants from the land, the land enclosures, the land clearances. That happened over a long period, but that had a devastating effect in terms of British life. Precisely, the mass of the people were separated from the means of production, had no choice but to go to work for capitalists. And indeed, as Marx details, from very early on in the development of capitalism, and we're talking here about Tudor times, they start passing laws that make it being a vagrant an illegal act. And they start passing laws that actually limit, you know, handouts by parishes to poor people. And you end up with these horrors called workhouses. I mean, in my area of London, there's one former workhouse up the road, and they used to be called Bastilles. and they had the separation of the sexes. And those that were capable of working were made to work. And the conditions were meant to be so grim that only the desperate would go to the workhouse. But we also have the exploitation of workers that I've already referred to. And if you look at Frederick Engels's fantastic book, The Condition of the Working Class in England, he gives figures for the average life expectancy of a working class person in, you know, in cities like Bristol. And I think the average life expectancy there was 25. The average life expectancy of a working class person in Liverpool was something like 27. Capital was killing off the first generation of workers. And it's from that that we have original accumulation, certainly not the capitalists saving up their sixpences and being, you know, clever businessmen. It's from the exploitation of black labor, but also white labor, which was separated from the land and forced to work in these satanic mills and other horror houses of the Industrial Revolution. So we don't want your guilt money. We created all of this wealth, and we want to collectively take hold of it, and we can only take hold of it collectively. So I think we need to have a contemptuous attitude to the Guardian, but the fact that they have their origins in terms of the money that's paying for the today's Guardian in the slave trade shouldn't surprise anybody. Look at any British institution of that sort of vintage, and you'll find the same story, I think, without exception.